This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism. Hashtag podcast. Hashtag broad on Joy 94.9.
This podcast is presented to you by Broad on Joy 94.9 at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival. Broad presents Writing Politics, Writing Feminism.
Because it is true what Margaret Atwood said, that women are afraid that men will kill them, and men are afraid that women will laugh at them. And you can see that, being, you know, the amount of times that I've watched as, you know, the typical kind of a young white boy has gone on and on and on about how women can't take a joke, or black people can't take a joke, we all just need to relax and be a little bit more like them and just understand that everything's just a joke, you know, just calm down and relax. Lose their shit the moment you say anything about young white boys on the internet. I once posted a... a little image of a comment that said, "How is that racist - white people proverb?" And it had like 1,000 comments on it within a day, most of them from young white boys complaining about how I was racist, I was sexist, how dare I, you know, like abuse, threats, etc., etc. So for me now, my way of fighting back is just to broadcast them further. So anyone who says, "Well, you're afraid of, you know, you're silencing freedom of speech," I'm like, "Well, I'm not, because I'm sharing your words with more and more people. I'm giving you a bigger platform. What you said, that, you know, I'm just giving you extra eyes on it." Because they also don't want other people to see what they're saying. You know, that's why they always say, "Oh, I was hacked," or you know, people have said to me when I shared that image of the guy who wrote a comment on my, it was a public comment even. This was a private message that he sent to me calling me a lesbian slut and he was going to come around to my house and rape me. Now, I don't actually believe that threat, you know, so it wasn't like I read it and I was scared, because I've read so many things like that that I have either, you can either consider it the luxury or the shielding of not being scared of that anymore. But I shared that and people will say things like, "Well, I'm not saying that this is okay that he said this, but you're just as bad, if not worse, for sharing it. See, this is a lynch mob, you know." So they want to be able to say whatever they want to you and have you just suck it up and be silent and scared. And because I refuse to do that, it makes them angrier and angrier. But someone very wise said to me once that it's not always about the people you're having the conversation with, it's the people who are listening. So when I take someone's comment and share it with other people, whether or not I'm doing it to make fun of them or whether or not I'm doing it to be more serious and say this is the consequence of being any kind of activist who sits outside of the dominant structure on the internet, what that does, I feel, is provide, it goes back to that idea of like validating other women's experiences for them, you know. So now I have women who email me, like, almost every day I'll get an email from a woman sharing a screen, like screen caps of a conversation that she's had online. And she's not, these women aren't afraid of it anymore. These women are often sharing it to laugh at it or to say, "Look at this disgusting man," or whatever. Sometimes they're a little bit afraid because they might not be at that point yet where they've become used to picking on it and laughing at it and fighting back. But for me, that's my tactic in responding to it, is to shine a light on it so that more and more women feel confident to be able to do the same themselves. So that I don't have women writing to me and saying, "Well, I left this comment on this thing and someone said something mean to me and so I deleted all of my social media accounts because I didn't want to be abused anymore." But instead they're fighting back on their own terms and laughing at these people. And the more kind of, the more that happens, I've used this analogy so many times, so apologise if you've heard me say it before, but it's a bit like the boggarts in the closet in Harry Potter. I don't know if everyone's read Harry Potter here, but the boggart is a creature that lives in dark spaces that when you see it, it takes on the shape of the thing that you fear most. And until you find a way to master that and turn use the ridiculous spell on it and turn it into something ridiculous to laugh at, it will defeat the person that it's presenting itself to. And I feel like that's a perfect analogy for these guys on the internet, that the more you laugh at them, the weaker they become and the more pathetic they become and the stronger everyone else around them feels to be able to fight back against them. It's not always possible, and sometimes people are really scary, and there's been a couple of times when I've been shocked at some of the things that have been said to me, or I've, you know, especially since having a baby, starting to think a little bit more critically about what I might do because I've got someone else to protect now. But generally speaking, I think that fighting back is a good tactic and one that makes other people, if I can bear the burden of that for other people in whatever small way, so that they can get the confidence to do that themselves, and that's something I'm very happy to do.
I experienced that a lot. The really frustrating thing is that you try to have an intelligent conversation with Twittersphere or with anyone, your friend on Facebook, and when your point is completely disregarded for the sake of some sort of trivial commentary on, like, well, did you know that Aborigines are really the settlers? That's the sort of stuff that really annoys me. And it's something that I've experienced it a lot. A lot of people close to me have experienced it a lot. And we don't normally take the approach that it's our responsibility to educate these people, because it really isn't. And if they're that set in their beliefs, you end up just exhausting yourself and expending all of this unnecessary emotional energy. However, when some of that collided with the actual physical, so a very good and close brother of mine, Birigan Dunvalesco, who was recently in the news because he's supposedly a radical terrorist because he called out Pauline Hanson's very racist agenda, and received all sorts of hatred and criticism, backlash and threats and stuff. People came to his geek and just this vile sort of outpouring of offence was launched at Birigan and his bandmates, and and the venue tried to support them, but the other band, Sticky Fingers, playing was just like, no, you're racist, you're not listening to these people, these white people, you're the racist one, all this sort of ridiculous nonsense. So what we ended up doing was we made an event for people that attended the gig, people that had been showing us, you know, criticism in the past. We made an event. We held it at Waterloo Tent Embassy. It's not an Aboriginal Tent Embassy, but it's got relations with Aunty Janie, who started Redfern Aboriginal Tent Embassy. And we said it's going to be a workshop. It's going to be a conversation, because we can't do this individually. So on Thursday night, we had about 200 or 300 people rock up. They sat down on a basketball court and they listened to Birigan, they listened to myself, they listened to some allies that we've been working very closely with. I'm part of an organisation called Student Support Aboriginal Communities. I'm also involved in a couple of other activist networks. And we sat down and we had this conversation, and it went for about 3 hours. We did all sorts of exercises, participatory engagements and all of that sort of stuff. I had the time to talk about why a lot of the things people are bringing into our organising spaces are causing problems. And I got one person who said that I'm a terrible person and I'm bad for feminism and that I'm ruining the world. But that was one person. One person out of 250 people that turned up that had any kind of issue with that. And we do know that in some respects the people that were willing to turn up there are reflective of an echo chamber. We do understand that. The initiative to bring yourself to that slightly damp basketball court in the middle of the night to sit down and listen to a couple of black fellas yarning about, you know, why you're all terrible people. You know, that's not something everyone's willing to do. But for those of them who are willing to be educated, hopefully, and we ask them to do this, they're going to then go and then have conversations with maybe 10 other of their mates. And if they keep on doing that, another 10 people are going to be informed. And this is how we can get a channel going. So I'm not saying that it is your responsibility to tackle this, but there are sometimes, if you have the right people and you have the right networks, sometimes you can actually affect some really positive change that you can bring out there into the open. You just have to make sure that you're doing it in safe ways, that you're not compromising yourself, and that you do have that support there to make sure this is going to be reaching outwards.
This is just a small comment. I think I've just been reminded that with a baby in the room, that this the Queen Victoria Women's Centre was originally the Queen Victoria Hospital for babies and mothers. And it was set up by women doctors back in the late 1800s for women by women, a very strong pro-feminist activist act back then. So I just wanted to... I've had both all three of my children here at this hospital, and in 62, 64 and 66, in fact, my last child died here, and I regarded this whole space as a sacred place because she died here. And so just to have a baby in the room with all of that background, it's delight. So thank you.
I'm just going to jump in. There was a really interesting point, I forgot your name, that you made before about black women, or that your friend had a lot of privilege and that you were really surprised. And I just wanted to particularly hear from you too, to kind of, if there are any comments you wanted to make around that, this kind of competing oppression, not competing, but how it can be oppressed, but also in some ways have privilege, or yeah, I just wanted to give you guys a chance to unpack that.
Hi, thank you very much. Wonderful panel. I'm Relinda Bobbis. I just want to thank you so much for reminding us to follow the money. That's very important. And I just want to get your comments on how money, political economy, impacts, you know, what stories are told around. Because as we find, you know, with mainstream publishers and even independent publishers groom only a few money earners, writers, and then the rest, writers of difference, disappear. So the other voices, and because it's like a cycle, you know, you earn money, then we support you, and then the others. So if you stop earning money, then they drop you. So that there are only certain stories that are, or in certain voices that are actually out there. So yeah, if you could please talk about that follow the money argument. Thanks.
So I'm torn between the controversies. Okay. So those sorts of things are admittedly they're sometimes a little bit challenging and difficult to hear. That these are the perceptions of black women, and we know that comes from a really complicated entangled history of exoticism of this sort of notion of the great kind of Amazonian woman is very, very prevalent still in our psyche. And so when you hear those sorts of comments, sometimes you like there's immediately a buzzer that goes on in your head, and you're just like, oh, what do I expect here? And you're immediately put on guard when you hear something of that nature. And it comes, you know, where I can speak to that a lot is this is something that we like to ask in workshops that myself and other people in my networks give. We ask people, are they scared of Aboriginal people? And most of them say yes. And they're scared of approaching us, they're scared of asking us what they can do, if they can do anything. And that anxiety usually means they do ask the wrong questions, unfortunately. So I think that anxiety is something that we do really need to be incredibly careful, and we do need to sort of negotiate. I think, Jenna, it was probably not explicitly coming from a state of complete disregard that this woman could possibly have any kind of oppression. I don't think we can sort of look at you know, like, hopefully we can't look at black women today and go, well, you've got all sorts of privilege, despite what the trolls on Twitter like to think, you know, apparently that I'm draining the government of all sorts of benefits, and I probably live in one of my five community houses. I don't know what they think. We do have to negotiate, and this actually comes quite neatly into that question of the commodification of certain voices over other voices. You know, one of the really important aspects of my feminism is just it is like overtly anti-capitalist. I do not believe that there is any way forward for the liberation of women if we are continuing to work under a system that is run by the explicit commodification of some bodies over other bodies. And in Australia, that capitalist system is built on the dispossession and exploitation of Aboriginal land. So this is all kind of interwoven, and we see value where we can see money, all of these kinds of issues. And some bodies are commodified with this intent of diversity being the kind of aim. Some ideas are commodified for the intent of inspiring diversity. You know, recently a special issue of a journal was published that featured exclusively white poets writing about decolonization. And that is not their territory. That is not their territory. So we do really need to be, in terms of attempting to kind of still navigate both of those questions. As I said, I'm sure that that's kind of situated in all kinds. Like, I don't, you know, I see myself as being, depending on what time of the year it is, white passing, so I know I have that kind of privilege, but I don't really think I can understand that impulse to look at an Aboriginal person and say, whoa, I'm terrified of you, or you must be the benefit of all of that kind of privilege. You know, but the thing is, if we have that anxiety, we're never going to get anything done. So that's really the sort of, I mean, I don't want to be as blunt and say get over it, but ultimately, if it's inhibiting your engagement with you know, this incredibly problematic term, people of colour, if it's inhibiting your engagement with anyone, you need to work through that, because that's not our responsibility or our burden to take on.
I have to say, in my traditional bad feminist guise, I actually have spent a couple of years with Shannon, and I had not once imagined that anything could be wrong in her life, because every time she was with me, every time she's with her white husband, she never has any kind of problem, so I wasn't witnessing it. And it was only when she sat down to reveal her story that I could see what was finally happening to her. Because, you know, when my parents came to Australia in 1951, they'd spent 6 years in a refugee camp. All my grandparents died in concentration camps. We spent, speaking of passing white, my parents' favourite kind of thing was to try and turn me into a faux Christian. Well, they haven't succeeded, because here I am still telling people I'm Jewish. I even told the census. So I think I want to say that I really want to echo what Evelyn says, which is that, you know, we need to try and talk to each other much more than we do, and stop being frightened of each other. But I also think that if you feel like your voice is not being heard, you might not be able to get paid to have your voice heard straight away, but there's 1,000 journalists who are on your side and want to help, and helping may not be the best way of decolonising, but it's the step. And I have to say, I'm not going to reveal the names of a half a dozen young women I've taught, but they're all women from backgrounds which are not white privilege. In fact, they're definitely not white, and they've all got their own things, paid spaces now. And then it's just fucking liberating for me to be able to see that there is a progression. If you're a person who has a paid space, you have a moral responsibility to talk about other voices and other experiences and other backgrounds than your own. You need to really talk about the way in which money influences our right to be as women. I mean, you know, a year ago we heard that the federal government was giving us $100 million for a domestic violence package. Well, you know, hardly any of that money went to, for instance, community law centres, and they are the people who are at the real forefront of battling family violence in this country. So you need to nag. I honestly would say to you, if you're frightened of being on the internet, tweet me, I'll pick on them for you. I'm good at that. I mean, we need to be more of, I hate this word, a, a, not an army, but a group of connected people who are working together for equality.
I don't know if I have anything. I was really interested in listening to the other panelists' perspectives on that. I don't know if this relates to the question, but just in terms of the limits of identity politics, I think identity politics are important and necessary, but I think that sometimes in the current activist circles we can become a little bit obsessed with the identity part of things and not necessarily be talking about the progression part of things, which is a really problematic thing for me to say because my identity is favoured by, you know, most of the dominant structure. So I do understand and recognise that, but I was talking to my partner about it, and he's like a maths thinking person. I'm not a maths thinking person at all. And he described it as being like, if you have a circle and you think of a square that can fit to that circle, and you're like, well, the square doesn't completely fit to the circle, so we'll make more squares to fit to the circle. And so to fill the space of the circle and to adequately try and represent every single possible iteration of any kind of identity, those squares have to become smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, but they'll never really fit the circle. So I guess the point of that being that I think that, and again, very problematic for me to say this, I'm not suggesting that anyone abandon identity politics, but there is sometimes value in, if you're having a conversation where it's being reduced to who has a right to speak within that space, and it's being really reduced to, you know, very specific kind of identity markers, then perhaps, and resulting in a lot of lateral violence amongst similarly oppressed people, then I think that those are challenges that we're facing now as activists and as writers, to try and accept the limitations of that and accept that there will be problems with that, but try and move forward somehow. And finally, I will qualify that once again by saying that I know that there will be to say that.
I wonder if you can all join me in thanking our four panelists.
This has been a special broadcast from Broad at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival on Joy 94.9.
Thank you, sisters. You've been listening to this Broad podcast here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget to tune in to us Monday nights at 9 p.m. on Joy for feminism in your ears.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.